This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before James Brown went to prison almost 2 years ago, he wrote an autobiography. My guest Bruce Tucker is the person who convinced Brown to tell the story of his life and collaborated with Brown on writing the book. Tucker is a white writer. He was teaching a course at Fisk University on the autobiographies of black musicians when he realized there was a big gap. James Brown hadn't written a book. James Brown, The Godfather of Soul, was published in 1986, the same year Brown had his first top 10 pop single since the late 60s. James Brown's imprisonment gave Living in America an ironic twist, a subject that's addressed in the epilogue of the new edition of Godfather of Soul. Bruce Tucker has kept in touch with Brown during his imprisonment. Brown is now in a work release program.
Well, at the moment, he's working in a community action center in Aiken, South Carolina, having served 18 months of a 6-year sentence. There's a possibility that he could get out very soon on extended work release, but at the moment, I don't think he wants extended work release because it's fraught with dangers for him.
What kind of dangers?
Well, when you're in that situation, all you have to do is make one tiny mistake, and then you're back in jail for the rest of the sentence.
And he's afraid he'd slip up?
Well, all you have to do, for example, is be late for an appointment, and he's certainly capable of that. But more sinisterly, I think, if there was someone who wanted him to mess up, it could be easily arranged.
What were the charges against him in the first place?
Well, what he was convicted of was refusing to stop for a police officer and aggravated assault. He received a 5.5-year sentence for refusing to stop for a police officer. So far as I know, that's the longest sentence in American history for what's essentially a traffic violation.
Oh, you got a traffic violation, but the cops are in hot pursuit.
Yes.
And he was fleeing from them across state lines, I think, and they fired, what, about 23 shots at him?
Yes, into the cab of the pickup truck that he was driving. So, believing himself to be in great danger, he put the truck in reverse. Two officers had to jump out of the way, and that was the basis of the aggravated assault charge. As he said, I aggravated them and they assaulted me.
Let's describe what the chase was about in the first place.
Well, in his office building where he maintains his business offices, there was an insurance seminar going on in the adjacent office, and they were coming over from the insurance seminar and using his bathroom, and he objected to it, and he walked into the insurance seminar, and he was carrying a shotgun that, so far as I know, was not even loaded and possibly not even functional. And he rambled a little bit about them using his property and so forth, and then he left, and someone called the police, and when he heard the police coming after him, he drove across the Savannah River into South Carolina, going home, no doubt, and then the South Carolina police chased him back across the river, and he was eventually apprehended in Augusta on the Georgia side.
I don't understand. Maybe you have a sense from talking to James Brown why someone of his stature would be so afraid of being stopped by the police that he would flee from them even while he was being shot at by the police. I mean, he's James Brown.
Well, he had been stopped and arrested and taken into custody 4 or 5 times in the preceding year before this last incident, and I think he wanted no more of it.
He was also high on PCP. There was a drug test done on him. There was PCP in his system.
Well, that's the story. I think it's important to remember that he was neither tried nor convicted for a drug offense.
Why wasn't he tried? I mean, if in fact the test was done and it showed PCP in his system, how come there weren't any official drug charges brought up?
Well, I suppose the authorities didn't feel that they could make the case.
Oh. Do you think the sentence was too harsh?
Yes, I think it's unquestionably too harsh. I don't think, of course, that artists or any other prominent person should be socially exempt from punishment like the rest of us. But on the other hand, even if you think he belonged in jail, and I certainly don't, 18 months is enough. Enough is enough. It's time for him to get out. He's clearly being punished for being James Brown.
My guest is Bruce Tucker, and he wrote an autobiography with James Brown that's just been reissued. And you describe James Brown as the most important living American musician. Let me ask you to describe what makes him that important.
Well, I think unquestionably he's the most influential. James Brown's music is everywhere now in the landscape of contemporary music. It underlies rap, dance pop, African world beat, jazz, funk, fusion. You hear it in the music of everyone from Prince to Herbie Hancock to Wah's Not Wah's to the Talking Heads. There's hardly a popular musician who hasn't been influenced by James Brown. And of course, he's heard most clearly in rap, where his songs and his voice and so forth are either sampled over and over again, or he's explicitly mentioned as the source of inspiration. So yes, I think he is the most important living American musician. And the music for which he should be known is the funk. He's called the Godfather of Soul, which is slightly misleading, because his enduring contribution to American music is funk, the records he made in the mid-60s through the early 70s.
Well, let's listen to the first hit that he had, and this is from 1956. The record was Please, Please, Please. Would you like to say something about this?
Well, this is James's first record. He recorded a demo of it in a Macon radio station, and it eventually got to King Records in Cincinnati, and he went up there, and the Famous Flames went with him, and they cut it, and it was a hit. It was a big hit.
Please, 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 please.
James Brown, Please, 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 recorded in 1956, and my guest Bruce Tucker wrote James Brown's autobiography with him, and it's just been republished. What do you think was different from this record by other music that was on the charts at the time?
Well, it's not really so different. I mean, that was the heyday of doo-wop and a lot and Southern gospel and the beginnings, the first stirrings of soul. But I think what's distinctive about it is James's voice. It's one of the most distinctive voices in American singing, as distinctive as that of Louis Armstrong, it seems to me, and is instantly recognizable.
And this is before he started shout singing.
Yes.
James Brown actually started to sing in jail, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Actually, he had done a few amateur shows and things like that before he was sent to jail. That is the first time, when he was 15 years old. And when he emerged from jail 3 years later, he formed a gospel group, which eventually evolved into an R&B group and became the Famous Flames.
Fill us in a little bit about his background. He came from a really poor background.
Yes, he was born out in the woods in South Carolina and moved into Augusta, Georgia, which was a wide-open serviceman's town at that time in the late 30s, early 40s. Lived in a brothel with an aunt named Honey Washington. They sold moonshine whiskey in addition to the other activities that went on in that house. Eventually, the house was closed down by the police. James then, as a pre-teenager, I guess you would say, began getting into trouble here and there. He broke into some unlocked cars to steal some clothes, got caught, and was sentenced to 8 to 16 years in prison for breaking into unlocked cars. Again, another extremely harsh sentence. He served only 3 of those years. He wrote a letter to the parole board saying that he wanted to get out and sing gospel for the Lord. He was known as Music Box in prison because of his singing. He got out, formed the group, and then about 6 years later, there came Please, Please, Please. And then after that, he conquered the Apollo Theater in New York and went on from there to become the superstar that he remains.
Well, you mentioned the Apollo Theater. Why don't we listen to something from his 1962 Live at the Apollo album? And James Brown, I mean, has been a spectacular performer. And this will give some sense of the more like show business aspect
of
his performances.
Yes, and the excitement of him as a live performer in front of the toughest audience in the world, the Apollo Theater audience.
And what we're hearing is James Brown getting introduced.
Yes.
So now listen, gentlemen, it is start time. Are you ready for start time? Thank you, and thank you very kindly. It is indeed a great pleasure to present to you at this particular time, national and international known as the hardest working man in show business, man that's saying, I'll go crazy. Bewildered. $1 million seller, lost someone. The very latest release, Night Train. Let's everybody shout and shimmy. Mr. Dynamite, the amazing Mr. Please Please himself, the star of the show, James Brown and the Famous Flame.
Well, I don't really want to say anything after that.
Not much to say.
No. Did he ever travel with his own announcer?
Oh, yes. In fact, quite well known, a man named Danny Ray, who does the announcing. I'm not sure that was Danny there. I think that was a man named Fats Gonder, who is now dead. But yes, he travels with a man named Danny Ray, who's responsible for the capes and so forth.
Is this a James Brown innovation to have your own announcer traveling with you to introduce you?
Well, I think the innovation is for a performer to put together an entire review like that with an orchestra and so forth, and to take it around from city to city and to hold it together for more than 30 years. Some of America's greatest musicians have come to grief when they tried to put together what's in essence a big band, if you will, and try to make it work. But James was always able to do that. Yes, he was. That is an innovation in a kind of show business way, and with the emphasis on business.
Would you describe James Brown's cape routine and how he created it?
Well, it comes at the end of the performance. Now he just simply more or less alludes to it in performance. But back when he was doing the days of Live at the Apollo and so forth, he would do a sort of collapse and resurrection routine at the end of the performance, because he would come out and knock himself out on stage for several hours dancing, singing, and so forth, and he was understandably exhausted. Of course, there's a good deal of histrionics involved, but he is genuinely exhausted. And in the beginning, one of the Famous Flames, the singers, would approach him, and they would put a raincoat around his shoulders and start to lead him off, and then he would shake it off like a boxer and come back out on the stage and go through the whole thing again, and until finally he would disappear. And then when the crowd had yelled long enough, he would appear again on stage dressed in a brand new suit and with a suitcase ready to hitchhike to the next town on the on the agenda. But after a while, as Bobby Bird, one of the Famous Flames, told me, they started to lose their raincoats, so they decided to get a cape. Nobody wanted to volunteer their raincoat anymore. But he got the idea of using the cape, interestingly enough, from watching the famous wrestler of the 1950s, Gorgeous George, who used a cape and behaved in a similar fashion in the wrestling ring.
What about James Brown's hairdos? He used to have this really large process, and then in the late 60s got an afro, but his hair has always been a really important part of his style.
Yes, and getting that sort of modified afro in the 60s represented a painful concession for him, because he's always been very proud of his hair. In fact, if you look at the pictures in the book and you see the way in which his hair has evolved over the years, you get a kind of brief synopsis of cultural history right there.
And as you say, James Brown is really the godfather of funk. And the turning point for him in terms of starting to play funk was his 1965 record, Papa's Got a Brand New Bag. What was different about this record, and what did James Brown have to tell you about it?
Well, at this point, he didn't have to tell me anything about it, because it's been so influential. It's something that we now can hear very easily. But the difference in funk is that, for one thing, in jazz, for example, the the emphasis falls on the first and the third beats in the measure, and in rock and roll on the second and the fourth, the famous backbeat. Whereas in funk, all of the rhythmic emphasis is on the one, is on that first downbeat at the beginning of a measure, and it really drives the music forward. You can hear it in this song in Embryo, and then in later work quite clearly. And the other thing is the polyrhythmic complexity, which is what James is known for. The other thing I think worth noting about this record is the date, 1965. If you recall, soul of both the shouting and the churchy varieties didn't peak until 67 or 68, and then more or less ended with the death of Dr. King. But in 1965, James was already leaving soul behind for funk. I mean, it's an amazingly revolutionary record if you put it in historical perspective like that.
I really like something he said to you about this record. He said that he discovered his strength wasn't in the horns, it was in the rhythm. He said he was hearing everything, even the guitars, like they were drums.
Exactly, yes, and I think that is the key to funk and the key to James Brown. Everything is used percussively, the voices, the guitars, the drums. He carried two and sometimes three drummers during this period on the road. Yes, everything is used percussively. I think one of the difficulties in making the case for musicians like James Brown for their importance is that Western music theory downgrades things that aren't important in European classical music, such as rhythm, and so there's no means of adequately notating it or so forth, or appreciating it, and so we're in a sense trained not to hear it, but it's there, and that's James's great, great achievement.
This is James Brown, 1965. That's James Brown, and my guest Bruce Tucker worked with James Brown on his autobiography, James Brown, the Godfather of Soul. James Brown is kind of a riddle to me politically. I mean, he had that really big and really influential record, Say It Loud and Black and I'm Proud, in 1968. He had supported H. Rapp Brown. At the same time, though, he supported Richard Nixon and played at Richard Nixon's inaugural. Can you help reconcile those two different political parts of James Brown?
Well, I think that it's difficult to reconcile the parts of James Brown, because I think James Brown is deeply ambivalent about a great many things, and I think it shows up in precisely those kinds of oppositions that you set up. He gave money to the H. Rapp Brown Defense Fund. He also bought a lifetime membership in the NAACP. He was a great admirer of Dr. Martin Luther King, and he's very close to Reverend Al Sharpton. He made a record that was almost contemporaneous with Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, called America Is My Home, for which he took a great deal of heat from a great many people. So I think that there's a deep contradiction in him, and I think it's difficult to reconcile. I think it's difficult for him to reconcile, because this country has greatly rewarded him and viciously punished him throughout his life, beginning from the time he was a child and right up to the present. So it's difficult to reconcile. The song "Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud," which appeared in '68, of course, cost him his crossover audience. People became afraid to come to his concerts and so forth. And if you listen to the song, of course, what you immediately notice is that it's almost a children's song. There's a children's chorus on there singing the refrain.
Well, let's do what you just suggested a moment ago and listen to his 1968 record, Say It Loud.
Put your bad self. Say it loud. I'm black and I'm proud. Say it loud. I'm black and I'm proud.
James Brown recorded in 1968. One of the things James Brown talks about in the autobiography is how he hated disco and how he thinks he was really hurt by it.
Yes, unquestionably. In fact, he all but retired in the late 70s. All of these revolutionary records, you can hear and say it loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, in addition to being an anthem of black pride, it's also a really stripped-down, bare-bones, propulsive funk record, as funky as any record he ever made. All of that music that he made then in the late 60s and early 70s was suddenly obscured by disco. And it depressed him, and he all but retired from performing in this country. He still performed in Europe and Japan and so forth, but he semi-retired. He encountered a lot of personal problems at that time also. His second wife left him. The son, who was the apple of his eye, was killed in an automobile accident in upstate New York. And he retired for several years, in effect.
Did rap create a comeback for James Brown?
Well, actually... James's comeback in rap more or less coincided. I think what brought him back, and I think he would be the first to say this, is his appearance in the Blues Brothers, the motion picture, mm-hmm. in 1980, and then subsequently in one of the Rocky pictures in which Living in America was included. But yes, rap has certainly brought him back. I think another thing that's been happening, and it's absolutely astonishing, is the critical reevaluation that has gone on of James Brown in the last 5 years. We've been talking today about how important he is as a musician. This is not merely my opinion. I think you would find that this is now the consensus among popular music critics, and it's an absolutely astonishing turnaround, because as recently as 1980 or the early 80s, the critics were relatively indifferent to him. But I think that that's explicable, because most people who write about popular music are middle-aged white men who don't dance.
Do you dance?
Yes, but I'm still a middle-aged white man.
When was the last time you spoke to James Brown?
About 2 weeks ago. I spoke to him by phone in the at the Community Action Center where he works.
And what was his mood?
I would have to say that he sounded a bit more downhearted than I have heard him in a long time. He's really indomitable. I think that's been true of him throughout his life and career. But I think he's been in there long enough, and I think he thinks that as well.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
My guest has been Bruce Tucker, and he worked with James Brown on writing Brown's autobiography, The Godfather of Soul, which has recently come out in revised paperback edition. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
All you copycats out there, get off of my tip, because I'm James Brown with the full force. Ain't taking no lip. Bad, trying to do it the way.